87 years ago, on the day that we're recording this, the working class of East London, made up of Jewish and Gentile men and women, trade unionists, socialists, and anarchists, stood down and fought not only the police, but those whom the police were protecting. That is, Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. The Black Shirts, those same fascisti whom elements in the British press, such as the Daily Mail, once shouted hurrah for. This was the Battle of Cable Street, where it was decided that the enemy, in the advocacy of violent class and racial oppression, would not pass. They would not spread. They would not speak. Even before the horrors of the Second World War and the Shoah, it was recognized that this could not pass. This could not be allowed. Not even through the universities and their various debating societies and presses. The fascist stain would be tackled by any means necessary. The tactics of anti-fascism are wide and diffuse, but the one we are here to discuss today is one of the most contentious and, in my view, one of the most necessary in the contemporary media ecosystem. A media ecosystem where transphobia, racism, homophobia, and reaction are all fermenting into a new foghorn of contemporary fascism. The tactic is this: no platform. No platform for those who would advocate for the destruction of our comrades and their right to health and happiness. Today, I have the privilege of being joined by the historian, archivist, and theorist Evan Smith to discuss his history of no platform as a tactic amongst the British left and its relevance to understanding contemporary right today. His book, No Platform, A History of Anti-Fascism, Universities, and the Limits of Free Speech, is out on Routledge, and he is currently working on an ongoing project chronicling one of the antagonists, I guess we could say, of this discourse, the Revolutionary Communist Party, and its afterlives as spiked online and its network, which has found such strange bedfellows from Boris Johnson to Viktor Orban. Evan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So first and foremost, I just want to, if you just summarize what no platform is. It's not just a tactic, but it also named a distinct policy, which is kind of bureaucratically sort of inserted into universities. How does no platform work in university bodies, and to what extent is it still operative today in many universities, particularly in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, so no platform is essentially the concept that fascists and racists and in some cases, other forms of bigotry and hate speech and stuff like that should not have a platform. It emerges out of anti-fascism in the 1970s, particularly crossover between the student left and the kind of the Trotskyist left, that the universities should not be a place where they should have a platform, so no access to student union buildings, not being invited to debate or speak on university premises. Student union funds shouldn't be given to groups that like the National Front Youth Group or whatever, and not being able to have that kind of platform. It starts out in the universities because it's a place where the students can kind of organize and have some kind of say in how that space is used and run. And like my kind of history, like looks at the university campus as a contested space. It's public, but also not public. Like it's not like the streets where we see much more confrontation between fascists and anti-fascists and stuff like that. It is a place, you know, where people could congregate, but there is a limit on who can be inside this space. So when it first developed, no platform is in the early 1970s. The National Front in Britain is in the ascendancy, and they're trying to make their presence known on university campuses, sometimes through intimidating the student left, sometimes being invited to debate or speak at different universities. And no platform was this kind of this idea from the Trotskyist groups, so the International Marxist Group, the International Socialists, and some members of the Communist Party, saying that actually, no, we need to take a stand against this, that groups like the National Front can't be on campus. And so in 1974, they convinced the National Union of Students to have a policy of no platform, or that it's not worded as no platform, but it's like a platform won't be given and they'll be denied by any means necessary. This includes disruption of meetings, et cetera, et cetera. So no platform at its basic is that you don't give a physical platform to fascist groups to preach their message, to organize, to sell newspapers, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where it comes out of. And then it morphs into different areas. So we talk about deplatforming, which is that should the far right, should fascists have access to social media, like the like calling for like fascist groups to not be on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And also kind of like in the media, like you don't invite fascists to be on BBC panel programs like Question Time and Nick Griffin in the 2010. So it goes off in different areas, but originally it starts as an idea from the university saying that no, there should not be a space available for fascists and racists to expand their message.
When it comes to the history of British anti-fascism, of course, I started with a sort of riff on the Battle of Cable Street. To what extent has that like, tactic basically developed out of an early history of anti-fascism? And is it in a way sort of trailing the successes and successes against Mosley, basically, against the Black Shirts from the 1930s onwards? And I guess how does no platform sit amongst sort of a wider practice of anti-fascism? Because there's a tendency to reduce anti-fascism in sort of its very discursive media landscape to simply taking the platform away. But it's part of an extensive toolkit, as I understand it.
Yeah. So the people who have developed no platform in the 1970s and even through to today, like take inspiration from the anti-fascism of the 30s and 40s. Cable Street is very important. It's when the like over 100,000 people organize on the streets of London and say the fascism needs to be confronted. You need to do it in large numbers. We won't give them the physical space. We won't give them the platform to demonstrate, etc. And it comes off some earlier interventions. So in 1934, there's two big ones. In June 1934, there's a disruption of a British Unifascist rally at Olympia, where Communist Party members and other anti-fascists like get access to the rally and then heckle, and eventually they're turfed out. And then there's like in later that year, the BUF try to have a rally at Hyde Park, and like that, then there's like masses descend on Hyde Park and refuse to let the BUF hold their rally. So there's a kind of this idea of like, yeah, you don't let fascists organize, you don't let them speak. There's a campaign in the 30s to not let fascists hold meetings at town halls and stuff like that. So like particularly spaces that are owned and operated by local councils, so that anti-fascists would compel like local Labour councils particularly not to let the BUF hold their meetings in buildings. After the war, we see this again. Like the fascists are smaller. Obviously, the Second World War has diminished their size, but they start like speaking on street corners and stuff like that. So there's a place like in East London, in Hackney and Dalston, where places along Ridley Road, where they're trying to have these kind of like soapbox speeches. And anti-fascists like the 43 group, which is kind of like a mixture of Jewish activists and communists, their tactic was called jumping the pitch, where they would like physically occupy the space where the fascists would organize so they couldn't like have that space to get on their soapbox and stuff like that. And so it was about a physical denial of space. But yeah, like, anti-fascism is not just confrontation. It's not just street fights. It's not just no platforming. It's a whole bunch of different tactics. It's about fighting elections. It's about putting anti-fascist arguments to people. It's not just about confrontation, but there is a need in a lot of it to kind of like realize that the fascism doesn't sit in the kind of normal space of politics, the normal political landscape, and it shouldn't be treated as just another political view. There's something inherently more dangerous. Like Nigel Copsey has written like a lot about anti-fascism and the history of anti-fascism, and he talks about like legal anti-fascism, he talks about militant anti-fascism, he talks about liberal anti-fascism. So yeah, like no platform is a militant tactic, but it is not just the only tactic used by anti-fascists.
I very much appreciate the focus you put on the literal spatial aspects of no platforming, because it basically just goes through material concerns thereof, denying them that space. But also how sort of weird it can get now when it comes to the notion of no platforming in cyberspace, when it is increasingly constructed of platforms. And so I guess in a sense, to use a technical term, the term has been totally deterritorialized into cyberspace. And I mean, how do you think sites sort of the media ecosystem of cyberspace, or at least the internet, has changed the tactics or even the language in which we speak about deplatforming?
Yeah, so that's the thing, is that like no platform, and what I've really looked at is about no platform at universities, because that's still a lot of the time it's like inviting someone to speak or like a student group organizing. But yeah, like the far right have always had a hand in using the internet to spread their message and organize and stuff like that. And it's a difficult thing. Like it's that a lot of the time I kind of differentiate no platform is something more physical and something more kind of like about the real world, if we in inverted commas, while like we talk about social media and online and talk about deplatforming. One of the problems with deplatforming is that often it is appealing to tech giants like Twitter or Facebook or stuff like that. Stand up people, nice guys, like to deplatform. And that runs the risk of like, relying on tech giants to decide who and who shouldn't have a platform. There are groups like Hope Not Hate, which have made this a very much part of their kind of deal, is that kind of not letting explicitly extremist groups have like social media accounts. And there's like pressures on like things like PayPal and other kind of online entities to not let them use the services. And that's fraught with danger, because with the Nigel Farage banking fiascos, who decides who is politically allowed to have this? I think the thing with no platform and the way that I've looked at it at universities, because I try to limit myself, and is that it's a grassroots tactic. It's a tactic from below. It's something that is student-led. It is bureaucratic, but like a lot of the times they're not asking the police or the university administration or something to stop an event from going ahead or something. It's like an action by students. Deplatforming gives up the agency, and it's something that the left wrestles with. Like liberal, there's a lot more kind of centrist liberal kind of agreement with deplatforming. So where you could get like kind of mainstream anti-fascist groups like Hope Not Hate supporting it, but it makes other people more wary. So Jeff Sparrow wrote a great book about the Christchurch massacre and online extremism, and the title escapes my head, but there's a book by Jeff Sparrow, who's an Australian writer, and he wrote this book in the wake of the Christchurch massacre of really teasing out those complexities, which I think not a lot of other people have. It's not just a simply like asking Elon Musk to shut down far-right Twitter accounts, because he's not going to do it. We know that.
The changing nature of cyberspace as well, it also seems to change the very aims of what space is used for and the dissemination of ideas. I mean, when it comes to, for example, having like debate, there's a slew of, leftist debate, have a fascist on one tweet, debate them, and then so on and so forth. But it's not so much like in the university space. We are denying the space to get like 30, 40 people in and then spread it to those 30, 40 people. It's more like on the online space, it's more like the critique is ultimately something along the lines of, if you're doing like a podcast together, you're both making content together. It's like the medium is the message. So no matter how good you are at arguing, you still ultimately sort of end up disseminating them. And I mean, the example I used to use is, it's like playing on an album together. I don't care how much your guitar solo really disagreed with that drum fill. You've both contributed to the same album. It's the medium is the message, ultimately. I think that's the limits of it. But that I think ties into one of the main critiques of note platforming, which sort of presupposes that we have to sort of debate fascists. But not only that, but we have not so much debate their ideas, but they also have to be in the room and treat it as if everything they are saying, unlike Sartre's anti-Semite, is completely sort of in good faith. Which is weird, because they all write books. You can just read the books, critique them. But, you know, Matt Goodwin, we have to have him in the room with his book, although, no, he once ate his book on TV, so I think that's actually quite dangerous. But just want to go on to this one question about, because there was an example of British anti-fascism which didn't use, or at least it has a mythology around it that doesn't have no platform within its sort of tactical repertoire. And that is the case of the BNP leader, Nick Griffin, who, after making some sort of electoral gains, particularly around sort of East London, sort of Barking and Dagenham, the myth is he came on to Question Time, which, if people, the listeners who aren't based in the UK, is essentially a ask a bunch of pundits and politicians some questions, and the audience will ask questions. The audience was being picked by someone who was tied to the EDL at one point. And I think if you look back, you can see that reflected. That's how neutral that is. But yeah, the mythology was that he came on, he was exposed to the fraud he was by the virtuous arguments of the audience and the panelists, and then the polling collapsed overnight. And one of the best things about your book is you sort of poke holes in the presuppositions of that as it comes to actually how it occludes sort of grassroots organizing and anti-fascist organizing outside of it. So what do you say was the sort of the holes in that sort of argument, at least from the historical data you've looked at?
Yeah, so one thing is that the British National Party, so the BNP, they win, I think, two seats at the European elections. So they have two members of the European Parliament, I believe one in London and then one in like the Northeast. And Nick Griffin, he's invited on Question Time. He doesn't do particularly well. He looks like he doesn't have many answers. And the kind of the liberal myth is that, look, he's exposed to the fraud he was. There was a lot of criticism of Nick Griffin being invited, and for Jack Straw, as a Labour politician, to be on the panel with him, that previously the Labour Party had some kind of not informal, but kind of like wishy-washy, no platform position, that they wouldn't share platforms like debating stages with the National Front. But Jack Straw does this on national TV, and kind of this myth is that support starts to ebb away from the BNP because Nick Griffin looks like a buffoon. One thing is that the polling around the BNP actually, I think, goes up in the immediate aftermath, and they kind of like that people go like, oh, he still sells something's all right, you know. But the vote does collapse for the BNP over the next little while. But that's not really to do with like him being on TV and exposed as like kind of like a hateful bigot, but because of local anti-fascist campaigners from the Labour Party, from the Socialist Left, from organizations like Unite Against Fascism, Hope Not Hate, organizing to get out for people to not vote for the BNP in the elections. So like in the 2010 general election, the BNP vote goes down. That's because people are saying don't vote BNP on the streets. That kind of the idea that the Griffin Question Time is a cause of the downfall of the BNP overlooks the kind of the grassroots campaigning, like the people from below. And it's like a mass campaign, like Billy Bragg and all that, because he's the Bard of Barking. He gets all involved in that. So I bet. And then also one of the other things is that I think not mentioned is that after 2009, the EHRC, the Equality Human Rights Commission, like actually have a kind of case against the BNP about membership laws and stuff like that, because because the BNP is a racialist organization, that there's a kind of a discrimination issue. So they actually had to like spend a lot of money fighting a case in court and dealing with that kind of a bureaucratic anti-fascism, something that has also been critiqued by the left for its kind of uselessness for a long time.
Before we get any deeper into the Britishisms, Craig.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you for coming on, Evan. It's really nice to meet you. I've been following you on Twitter for a while and have been inured to this discourse now for about 3 years since meeting Adam. And I just wanted to, my place in this discussion is as a kind of neophyte or naive American, in the sense that I don't know, or I haven't been inculcated with the history of British politics as a result of living there. And even as somebody who's worked with the left here in America, and perhaps even considering the generational divide between me and Adam, it's interesting to have encountered this body of work that you have provided and are archiving for us. Because as Gen X leftist, you know, I came from a position that honored free speech and so on. And then, of course, with 2016, Bernie Sanders and the kind of politics that cropped up around there, here in America, not that this was the first time that I heard about deplatforming, but it seemed to have come to the fore in that moment. And upon meeting Adam and all the comrades that I work with now, it's just interesting to see. I mean, interesting might not be the right word, but it's unusual to see the extent to which deplatforming and the movements against it. And I'm thinking about the British left that then became the conservative parties and so forth. It leaves a lot of questions open. For example, what is to be done with respect to how we deal with fascists online? But I think the important question that I want to put forward is, it seems that not only is this issue from a media standpoint entrenched in British politics, maybe more so in the UK than America, but my question is, what about this financial connection that's involved with those on the side of suppressing the no platformist movement, or what we call today anti-woke politics? Because it seems that between the United States and Britain, there's a cross-pollinization of politics, of strategies, and even of money. And if you were talking to an American leftist or even somebody who wasn't a leftist and you wanted to elucidate what has happened in the past 50 years in the UK and how that has had impacts for the Anglophone left and Anglophone politics in general, how would you talk about that? Like, what are some important notes that you would provide either from your own book or some resources that you would direct them to?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I'm going to take it in two ways. I'm going to give actually like that the history of No Platform is very UK centric, but it does have some history in America. That so No Platform is a term that is kind of transnational now, and a lot lefts use it. There's one group in the United States in the 1970s using it. That's the Spartacists. So the Trotskyists, like a kind of quite esoteric Trotskyist group, starts in New York, and they're using No Platform as a term as a concept in the 1970s. They're organizing demonstrations against like the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party. That if you go to like the Marxist Internet Archive, which has the kind of the full back catalog of the Spartacus newspapers, as well as the Socialist Workers Party, you can see them like having debates about how to approach the American far right. That the Ku Klux Klan try to come onto campus, the American Nazi Party tries to march through Skokie in the 70s, and the Spartacists are there saying no platform for fascists, KKK out. And they have this fight with the Socialist Workers Party, because the Socialist Workers Party is like, well, First Amendment, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. So the Spartacists, like, for all their kind of weirdness, are actually like quite a right at the front of using that kind of rhetoric in the United States. David Renton, long-term anti-fascist author, he wrote a book, No Free Speech for Fascists, and which he compares on both sides of the Atlantic, like the Britain and the American case. And so he kind of teases out that there's kind of debates. And like the American left, because the First Amendment particularly like has a different attitude in many ways to free speech, because it's legally enshrined in many ways. So it's kind of not the same. So, but also does have this crossover. And I'll also mention a recent book that's just come out by Lauren Shepherd called The Rise of the Right, which looks at right-wing groups on American campuses since the late 1960s and those kind of fights about platforming. They don't, like, the United States doesn't have an NUS. It doesn't have that kind of formal student union national structure. So it becomes much more localized, and that you go through student newspapers from the United States is that these become much more ad hoc little battles. Going back to the 60s, like when George Lincoln Rockwell, who is the leader of the American Nazi Party, tries to speak at local colleges and people, you know, heckle or disrupt or physically prevent him from trying to talk. So there is that history there in the United States. But you're right, that this is something that's transnational, that particularly in the last 10, 20 years, like there's a cross-fertilization of ideas from the US and Britain, and it spreads out as well. So Australia is very much where I am now, is very much kind of also plugged into this. Canada, New Zealand, they're all kind of feeding off these ideas of each other. And like, and we can point to things like the Koch brothers. They fund various kind of free speech campaigns and movements. George Monbiot wrote for The Guardian many years ago now that the Koch brothers had given money to Spiked to kind of run these kind of free speech campaigns, to kind of like give like, kind of like, yeah, free speech for everyone, nothing should be banned and stuff like that. And Spiked is the kind of successor of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and is that kind of the shift from the left to the right.
Oh, before you go on, Evan, this was something that was new to me when I met Adam for the first time. I was aware of Spiked Online, but it wasn't until I met British friends that I really understand what was happening with them. So imagine meeting an American guy like me for the first time, American person for the first time, and they ask, what is Spiked Online and what's the connection to the RCP and what is it that they're doing today?
Yeah, so Spiked Online is like, you might have come across it, you might not have. You might have been privileged in not having to read it. But they're very much plugged into that kind of transnational right-wing culture war discourse. It's a website that's been around for about 20 years, but in the last 10 years, it's really kind of taken off, that some of the people who contribute to it are on like television, radio, and like Frank Faridi, who writes for it. He's like working for a Hungarian think tank. Claire Fox, who's contributed to Spiked, she's now in the House of Lords. Mick Hume, who was the first editor of Spiked, I believe, writes for the Daily Mail. Brendan O'Neill, who's like chief editor at Spiked, he's regularly on kind of like cable news in the UK, and he writes for like Australian outlets, and I'm sure that they're in America as well. But yeah, like the origins of Spiked is a really far left small Trotskyist party, which exists in Britain from the late 70s through to the 1990s. And that they were like ultra left in many ways, is that they were like, they took up like no state collaboration, no compromise with the Labour Party, militant anti-fascism, militant solidarity with Irish Republicanism, that kind of thing. So in many ways, they had this kind of really kind of like bolshy, kind of like far left Trotskyist attitudes. But at the same time, is that they were unpredictable and had like that weird positions on many things. So like in the miners' strike, they took a minority position that there should be a national ballot, because the way that the miners' strike unfolded is that kind of like it happened, and then the the union had to kind of just like go with it. And it was kind of not decided like formally that yes, there should be the miner strike, but it just kind of unfolded. So the RCP had the kind of that minority position that that no, we'll go back to drawing board. There needs to be a democratic consensus that there should be a miner strike. And they called for this national ballot, which didn't win them many friends on the British left during that. They thought the AIDS crisis was overblown, and they kind of thought that kind of the discourse around AIDS in the 1980s was kind of was an excuse to crack down on gay rights. And they're kind of very kind of like wary about safe sex campaigns, for example. And on this kind of free speech thing is that they thought no platforming was bad because it was a ban on free speech. They said that we don't ask the police to intervene against National Front. We do that ourselves. So we shouldn't support no platform because it's asking universities or student unions to crack down on the free speech of people. And that snowballs as the party shifts rightwards in the 90s into no platform is bad, or because you can't ban anything, free speech for everyone, offensiveness is just a subject thing. The real problem is censorship. It's not fascism.
Adam, I pass it back to you.
I got it. Whenever I talk about this whole sort of letter, it is hard not to just look completely batshit, isn't it? So yeah, there's a split in the revolution. There's a split in sort of some international Trotsky tendency over some reading of Capital Volume 3. And then this one Hungarian dude just has like a really popular magazine with all his mates. And then suddenly, jump ahead 20 years, they get sued for genocide denial, and then suddenly they're everywhere. So you have Munira Mirza working with Boris Johnson for 14 years. Boris Johnson gives the Revolutionary Communist Party a school, which is basically just some sort of weird French already sort of coming up on the scene, great Uncle Frank in speech. Then one of them gets in the House of Lords, Claire Fox. Then they have about 40 front groups, including Siberia, one of the first like internet cafes in the United Kingdom. They're in these Trotskyists are in every paper. And then they have about 40 different bloody front groups about Don't Divide Us, Sense About Science. Andrew Eddy starts running the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, and they're just fucking everywhere. And then suddenly you looking from this history of the British left, and you see Frank Furedi with a very sort of fascist like eagle logo on his Substack at CPAC working with Viktor Orban. And then I'm like, okay. I mean, how does this get? This seems like it's spiraled. There might be some sort of dialectical progression here from a certain reflexive contrarianism to what they are there, which is, so if you go on Spikes Online, they don't recommend you do so. Type in the word trans. It is a transphobic, exterminationist hate mob. And yet it's in everywhere. You go on the Moral Maze, it's there. You have the Battle of Ideas Festival. These people are everywhere. It's completely that shit, just saying like, so guys, who's that guy? Well, now I'm going to tell you. So in one day, there was a living Marx, and yeah, Boris Johnson's been working with the Revolutionary Communist Party. You sound nuts. So, I mean, how does it get to this point? And I guess, is there any sort of thing that the left can learn from sort of the step, the point where they got to this? Because, I mean, look, let's be honest. This is going out on the Zero Repeater channel. Look through the backlog when it was owned by the other guys. You're going to see a lot of fucking familiar faces there, aren't you? I mean, we were literally brought on to more or less just kick it down the stairs and keep kicking. But it's bloody everywhere. And it still has this weird allure of kind of this. I mean, because they were the cool party, weren't they? They had the leather jackets. They had the cool magazine. They had the in-house post-punk band, Easter House or something. Like, is it just maddening thinking about this? So this goes to that question. How did it get this weird to an extent? Do you have a sort of thesis on that? And what can the left learn today to not be like those guys? Because it seems like there's a sort of temptation I've noticed of looking at the so-called, I'm not going to say the word anti-PC leftist that ends up just on the page of Spikes Online.
Yep. Yeah. So like thing is that like RCP starts out as this kind of Trotskyist group. They're very small. they don't make a lot of friends on the left. And by the late 80s, seem that they have like kind of some very left-wing ideas. And then other ones that, as I mentioned before, like the AIDS crisis, their position on that and the position on the miners' strike and all stuff. They're kind of like the Robinson Crusoes of the left, is they stand alone. When the Berlin Wall falls down, they start to have a change of heart. And I think it's also kind of a result of their kind of isolation, is that they start to move towards not being an activist group on the ground, but kind of emphasizing the battle of ideas. The Frank Furedi, his kind of nom de plume was Frank Richards, like his party name. And he writes this article for a new magazine they've got called Living Marxism, Midnight of the Century, that Leninism has failed, Labourism has failed. Like, this is after the third. We're coming up to the fourth election that Labour loses. And there's kind of a disillusionment and a withdrawal from kind of working class material politics. And to talk about ideas, ideas is like where it's at. That the way that forward to convince people is this battle of ideas. Instead of like massive demonstrations, they're organizing these big talkfest events, particularly at universities in London, where you invite a whole bunch of different people to debate. And the magazine Living Marxism, it's slick. It's like, if you saw Marxism today in the 1980s, it was kind of like slick. The Living Marxism is, it's a step above. It's read by quite a few people, you know, who like the readership of Living Marxism is much bigger than anything that the Revolutionary Communist Party could have. And it goes in for kind of like that contrarianism. That if the left thinks one thing, we think another thing, but we'll use kind of like left-wing rhetoric to come up with our positions. So their slogans were like something like question everything, ban nothing. And they start to move from like this kind of from a left-wing perspective into something kind of like libertarian, contrarian, kind of like weird. It's hard to define. But it's a gradual rightward shift. And what kind of also contributes to the end of Living Marxism, as Adam mentioned, is the trial. They get sued for libel because they publish an article by a German writer who claims that like kind of ITN, so one of the news services, and some journalists in the UK had kind of doctored footage to do with the wars in the Balkans and kind of the ethnic cleansing there. And they really go on this kind of like this big thing about like the manufacturing of the story about the demonization of Serbia during the Balkans wars. Eventually they get sued, but instead of compromising or sort of settling the case, as they take it to the courts and they lose that case. They campaigned that this is a denial of free speech. And eventually the kind of the debt from losing that court case means they wind down. But now the internet is everywhere. They started an internet cafe in the 1990s when the internet, they're embracing the internet much more quickly than the rest of the British left. So like the SWP are still thinking the internet is like a bourgeois like thing that we can ignore the internet. But so by 2001 spike that they go, we don't need a physical magazine. People are eventually going to stop reading magazines. Where we need to be is online. So that's where Spiked Online comes from. And the people who were members of the Revolutionary Communist Party, it dissolves. The magazine has been the most important thing. They don't need a physical party membership. And they kind of spread into the ether, like let 1,000 post-Trotskyists bloom. And they go into everywhere. So Claire Fox, who is now like a lord or baroness, she's in the House of Lords, she creates a thing called the Institute of Ideas, which puts on these events of like everything is up for debate. And we'll invite kind of like a whole bunch of people from a whole bunch of different range of views, including some people with odious views, to kind of have these kind of public debates. McHume, he's like, he'd been the editor of Living Marxism at one stage, and he's now working with Spiked Online, but he's also writing a column for The Times. Faridi, he's an academic, he's a sociologist. He goes off into kind of academia, but then is kind of like getting and making a name for himself as a media commentator, and takes up more and more right-wing positions. So yeah, so like this year he's at CPAC talking about national conservatism, and now he's working with Hungarian think tanks, which have links to the Orban regime. And then there's a whole bunch of other people, but it also starts to attract a new wave of people who weren't in the party but kind of contribute. So people like Brendan O'Neill, Joanna Williams, like these people write in the dying days of Living Marxism, but then they're media commentators. They can write for Spiked. People like Munira Mirza, now she works for Boris Johnson. She's a policy advisor for, you know, over a decade. She's like closely linked with the Boris Johnson. She's working with all that. She starts off with working with the issue of ideas and that kind of post-RCP milieu. But she's a bit that the media says she was a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. I don't think that is the case, because she's like coming to university age at a time when the party is ending. But she's around those people. It's a cohort. It's a network. It's loose. People go in and out. So Kenan Malik, he writes for The Observer. He's written a new book, Not So Black and White. He comes out of this as well, but he hasn't taken he hasn't gone as far, and he's kind of divorced himself from Spiked in the last 10 years. But it goes off in different directions, and people come, people go, but Spiked is the kind of organizing vehicle for this kind of post-left. And lessons, as I said, it's a slippery slope from being contrarian to appearing on Spiked. So that there is a tendency on the left to say, to put two fingers up at convention and at left-wing convention. But that unchecked can lead into kind of, into kind of that kind of contrarian era, contrarianism for contrarian's sake. And then you end up like essentially parroting similar lines to the right just to annoy the rest of the left. And I'm not going to mention names, but you can see that kind of today with people who in the left who have a media presence, and sometimes they go, well, no one else is saying this, I'm going to say it. And then it ends up going from an irony to, you know, an unabashed political position. So that's the one of the things that the left is to be wary of, is that why are we arguing this? Are we being contrarian just for the sake of being contrarian? And who are we targeting with that contrarianism? We should be like cynical about a lot of things, but we can just get cynical too cynical and get wrapped up in kind of like talk fests. And then we end up, you know, writing for The Spectator.
It seems to me, and cards on the table here, there was a time at which I was in a Discord server for this channel when it was run by the previous folks. And it was interesting reading the last chapter of your book and seeing the quote where Roger Scruton said something to the effect of he wanted to dissolve all universities. And it's interesting to see a version of that view parroted on the old Zero Discord server by many people there, because they feel it's an incubator for the professional managerial class and so forth. We all know the rhetoric that goes with that. But I think listening to you here, one of my big questions is, where are we now? Because it seems, well, once again, there was somebody who was a big part of this channel in the past before we came on, who is now associated with the think tank MCC Belgium, with Frank Faridi. And it seems that there's an even stronger vested financial interest. One evening, I just spent an hour and 10 or an hour and 15 minutes listening to one of these conventions. And it just completely smacks of conservatism, talking about national sovereignty in the way that conservatives do. And so it's hard to even say that there's a gray area, especially now that you have a movement called national conservatism, where some people who used to be associated with this group are now appearing front and center at the podium. So where are we now? And what is the current landscape with respect? Like, what is the epilogue to your book?
Well, that's the thing, is that since I wrote the book, I published my book in 2020, and so much has happened since then. The whole Black Lives Matter statues, like the conservative government brought in legislation. I published the book, then the conservatives decided to bring in new legislation to kind of say that student unions can't, no platform, free speech and or is now, but you know, you can sue if you get no platform in the UK. That things are happening rapidly. And yeah, like that there is a kind of like a material interest in being that kind of like iconoclastic post-left person, that like it's spiked, it's to a certain extent like Unheard, Quillet, Compact, the Canadian one. There's kind of different versions of, I always get the names kind of because they're all kind of innocuous and you kind of go, oh yeah. But like, but you can see the networks, and I think that it's hard. Like that each time, like something like this happens, is that like, so, like particularly online, to a Twitter discourse is like, you shouldn't be interviewing Matthew Goodwin. You shouldn't be like, you shouldn't like share a stage with this person because that's not good. The left should have a kind of pro-trans position on things, and then like other sections who call themselves the left go, well, that's a middle class position, that's not very materialist, you're denying free speech. So one thing is that the left, the Anglophone left, like in Britain, the United States, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, like places like that, that have this kind of a similar political environments and a shared political environment, is being robust in their defense of minority rights, like, you know, being like pro-trans, like being like explicitly anti-racist, standing up against homophobia, standing up against misogyny and stuff like that, being kind of confident of that and being aware that the kind of like there will be people who use left-wing language to kind of end up arguing right-wing positions. So it is kind of like being discourse aware but also being robust in defense of kind of like of being in defense of those people who need to be defended.
And I remember being at a counter demo, so there's a lot of counter demos every month in Honor Oak against Turning Point UK, various GB news people, and just outright fascists, of course, who are less good at hiding it, protesting a drag queen story hour stuff, but just doing a big anti-trans protest. But some of the stuff I noticed was how much it is just about getting media. These people just want exposure because they see themselves as being able to go viral in a way. And it is interesting, the whole idea of we have to go on to these platforms, because it's a very materialist argument in the sense of it's material for the person who wants to sell books or get GB News's fee. And apparently, I mean, Unheard and Compact pay very well. I mean, Compact can, because it's loss-making. Unheard makes money, sadly. But there's definitely an idealism to this of their ideas don't have any effect, and that's why it's okay to sort of spread them with them. But my ideas are so great that they will just be wowed over and I'll be sort of like one of the good ones. And it does seem to really take that aspect exactly of the collective power, because it reduces it to the individual speaker. It doesn't sort of tie it to the collective voice, which says you're not welcome here. And I think that's just a really good thing, that just a necessity of collective struggle and collective solidarity beyond and being discourse sensitive. But I guess how can people be a bit more discourse sensitive about these kind of things? Because I mean, there is the thing of saying, oh, that person's part of the LM network, and they say, what's the LM network? And then they've already left because they think you're completely mad, because it's a completely mad story. Yeah. So how do we help? Yeah, how do we sort of tell people a bit more sensitive about this, or just say like, not just the biscuit voice, but sort of like, actually, this person is trying to trick you.
Yeah. Like, I mean, we're getting into stuff away from my historical brain, but the thing is, like, to be wary of people like who talk about rights, who talk about sovereignty and stuff like that. What are they actually arguing? And what, when they say that the woke left is actually a middle class thing, that, you know, that it's just a middle class elite and the real working class are actually kind of have traditional values, et cetera, et cetera. To be in interrogating what do they mean and what are they actually arguing? It's not just about individuals, but like the kind of the message, like that. A lot of time, like, you go, oh, that person's arguing, okay, I can kind of like ignore what they're saying. But, you know, these new people pop up all the time. They're like mushrooms. So it's being kind of like aware of like how the discourse on rights and class and this kind of like essentializing of like the working class, like that because they're economically, Trump voters are all economically challenged, so they feel left behind, so they don't feel connection to the left, so they move to the right. So when people are using, you know, the working class and working class values, or if they use like a signifier like white working class, that you can kind of like be interrogating those ideas. Yeah, like, I would like reading stuff by people like Aaron Winter and Aurelia Mondon and stuff like that, thinking about reactionary democracy, the books like that, like, yeah, they're very good at kind of unpacking, like Gavin Titley or Alana Lenton, like kind of like interrogating how the post, like sections of the right use left-wing language to advance right-wing ideas.
I would just call them watchwords, like you said, working class, even bourgeoisie, middle class. Those kind of words have different connotations between different groups.
I mean, another good piece to read as well is that Race and Class put out an amazing piece the other day called, I'm only saying this works, it's in the title, An Anatomy of Britain's War on Woke, and it's basically a giant chart. And longtime fan of Zero Books might see some familiar faces, but I know we're coming up to the hour now. Obviously, Evan, what are you working on now? How is the continuing historical work on sort of the RCP going? And I mean, is there a new book in the pipeline?
So, yeah, COVID put a big kibosh on my RCP project to get it done as quickly as I would like. But I am continuing with working on the RCP. Delving into actually what I've been doing is looking at the undercover police files that have been uncovered from the UCPI inquiry. They surveil the RCP in the early days. So that's one thing I've been looking at. I will mention that Jack Hepworth, who writes about the left and Ireland and stuff like that, he actually has a book coming out about the RCP that I think is coming out through Bloomsbury later this year. So yeah, my work is ongoing with looking at the RCP. My kind of formal book project at the moment is looking at moral panics, which is kind of like an extension of this, looking at the origins of today's culture wars in Thatcherism in the 1980s. And I wrote a thing for The Guardian like 2 years ago saying the war on woke has its origins in the moral panics of the 1980s. So my project is really looking at how did the various moral panics of the 1980s fit together into a kind of a coherent political package that the Thatcher regime, that the Thatcher government was able to exploit. So like the Section 28, so the kind of the moral panic against homosexuality and kind of the moral panic against immigration and the moral panic around video nasties, the moral panic around rave culture and around students and around all kind of things, how that all fit into one political package that was offered up as Thatcherism. So really kind of giving a prehistory of today's culture war is the next thing I'm working on. It has a lot of RCP stuff in it, but it also has an overlap with No Platform, it overlaps with a lot of things. And it overlaps with Suella Braverman going on about a hurricane of migrants, the kind of like that rhetoric. that moral panics.
Oh, yes. Cilla Braveman showing that she is the last member of the Revolutionary Conservative Party. Evan, thank you so much for coming on. I've wanted to do a conversation for a while. Huge fan of the archive work you're doing. Of course, put a link to your blog, Hatful of History, in the description. And thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me.